seen from Conspiracy Com, and the actual event doesn't start until tomorrow, and of course we have some huge airplane going by right now outside. So, but maybe you guys can hear that. It is a really crazy time right now, as you can appreciate it. And I've got all sorts of strangeness happening. So I hope that the producers will give me some feedback on if we are having any kind of weird problems and so on here. But in the meantime, it looks like we're full speed ahead, so I'm going to continue. First of all, let me say that I am speaking tomorrow morning. I think the actual time is something like 10:45. They tried to make it as late in the morning as possible. I am not a morning person per se, unless I stay up the night before and then I end up staying up in the morning, but that's a different matter altogether, which is kind of what happens to me sometimes. I have so much stuff going on, and sometimes it's amazing what can go on after 12 midnight. You can get clear thought happening and also do some research during those hours that can be more fruitful than other hours, in case you aren't familiar with that little trick. And that's kind of getting underneath the radar of the Matrix. And the other thing I want to say here is that I have been posting on my blog very regularly. If you haven't been following it, then you really need to be, because that's where the action is for Camelot at this time. That's where I post a lot of recent whistleblower source material that otherwise simply doesn't get out there. So you need to see it. It is on my blog. Now, on my blog, which is on the front page, by the way, of Project Camelot, so you can go to projectcamelot.org, projectcamelotportal.com, and projectcamelot.tv, which is our newest URL. And let's see, what else can I tell you? Oh, I'm going to be also speaking. So this week I speak at ConspiracyCon, and I get a whole 90 minutes for my talk, which, if you know Camelot, time goes by really, really quickly. So I just want to encourage you to also see if you can come down to Sacramento UFO Conference, which will be on the weekend of the 16th of June. And so that's just a couple more weeks away as well. And there'll be another lineup there, but it'll be fun as well. And I encourage you to come down. Very interesting times we are in, as you can appreciate. On top of that, I'm putting together some speaking engagements in Europe. And we're going to Lake Como. That does seem to be a definite. So anyone who's vacationing at Lake Como during the month of July may have the opportunity of being able to see me and Sean David Morton. This is the first time I'm announcing that he's going to be joining me, so it's going to be a lot of fun. Anyone who knows Sean knows that he also has a radio show on American Freedom Radio, and I believe he just joined up on Revolution to extend his show a couple more hours at night. And so he's got tons to say, and both of us cover some similar material, but we kind of have a different style, and of course we have our own sources. But the interesting thing is that the source material often tends to coincide, and that's where you get some very, very interesting synchronicities, etc. So I want to encourage you to know about that. We're also looking to extend into the rest of Europe. And so if you're in England, we're hoping to get to England also in the last couple weeks of July. So if you actually know, it's the, no, that's, yeah, yeah. What we're trying to do is avoid the Olympics. It was very funny but at any rate, I think, my understanding is the Olympics is the 27th of July to about the 12th of August is the actual Olympics. So we will not be in England during that time, but we will be in England, I believe, even after that. I think that's the plan. And in France prior to that. So we're trying to do Paris and certainly doing Lake Como for sure. That's Italy. Anyway, so if you want us to come to, I don't know, Barcelona, Amsterdam, whatever your city is, then do let me know and contact me at Project Camelot. So I have various email addresses, but they're all on contact on the website. But you can just sit right to Carrie at projectcamelot.tv. That's very easy, and that's the best email for me, actually, nowadays. So it's Carrie, K-E-R-R-Y, at projectcamelot.tv. I'm just trying to go through real quick laundry list here of stuff before we bring my guest, Brian Forrester, on, and hopefully I'm saying his name right. And this is going to be a really interesting show. I'm going to be learning as much as you are because I'm not all that familiar with his research, but he's a very, very well-known researcher. And getting into, well, what I call the Anunnaki skulls, he may have another name for them, I'm not sure. But we're going to go down that road, and I just want to make a couple more announcements because there are some stuff happening which is just really off the charts, and as you can appreciate, let's see, the Venus transit it's the 6th of June, so today is the 1st of June, and let me tell you, people. That I'm already feeling it big time, and I don't know what you've got going on out there. I'm having a massive samadhi events, kundalini events. If you're not familiar with that, it's the linking of the chakras, and it just puts you in an altered state, in a whole another ball game. And so that's happening as we speak here for me, and that does happen periodically, but it gets stimulated by certain, you might say worldwide events or energetic events that we're going through at this time. And so this is certainly one of them. What else can I say? I guess the zombie thing, if anyone's been going to my blog lately, they know there's been a lot of weird zombie-like occurrences. I call it Resident Evil in operation. That anyone familiar with the sci-fi series Resident Evil will probably know what I'm talking about. And sometimes it manifests, I guess, most graphically, I guess the ones in the news, and apparently there's some more of them. I mean, this is just really, really strange. But it was talked about in advance by Henry Deacon way, way long ago, back in just in the early days of Camelot, around 2006, when he was telling us about these various converging, you could call it converging timelines, but it was a convergence of events. And those events would be affecting the world, the planet, our universe, and certainly us in a massive way around 2012. And he warned us to prepare for these events, and he had a whole litany of preparation suggestions for us. Most of which I have not done. I've done a few of them, simply because it's not kind of my way to hole up, in that quite that same way. But, I do understand the philosophy that he had, which came from the military, industrial complex, the dark black projects that he worked for. But they were talking about how people would be affected by these energy surges and they would start losing their minds. And I have to say that Whitley Strieber also anticipated this in his book, which was called Grays. And I don't know if we changed the title of the book or whether the book just hasn't gotten as much notice as I expected it to. But at any rate, in the book, he talks about whole towns becoming like zombies, like in Resident Evil. So that's not a good scenario. We do not want that to happen. And I do not want to encourage that, but I do want people to be aware that people around them maybe start losing it in completely illogical ways. If you're not prepared, if your chakras are not prepared, the surges of energy coming in and hitting the earth at this time are just massive. And the powers that be have built underground bases to protect themselves from things like this and from crazies. They built camps to throw them into. And they've also built, they've created chemtrails to encourage you to go crazy. So we're in a very strange universe, as Sean David Morton, my friend, would say, which is really pretty funny that I even thought of that phrase right this minute. Okay. So that's enough of that. And let me bring on Brian Forster, who's been waiting very patiently. Brian, are you on the line?
Yes, madam, I am.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Well, I'm very well. I'm maybe a little too well for the likes of Internet radio, but we're going to just try to plow on through here. So I understand that you have been researching these skulls, and you've also been doing a tremendous amount of investigation, also with, it appears, Lloyd Pye, if I understand the bio information here, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and let me see if I can give you a little background introduction here. You've been on the History Channel numerous times. You're a Canadian explorer who moved to Peru to investigate the mysteries that are there, mainly are in the ancient sites, I imagine. It looks like you are the co-director of Paracas History Museum, and you study the elongated skulls that were found in that region. And then you do DNA analysis of the skulls. Very interesting. I'm going to be very interested to hear if you've gotten anything on that. And that you're an expert on megalithic sites, Peru, Bolivia. And you've been speaking with indigenous wisdom keepers and believe those sites to be, let's see, much older than the Inca originally thought. So that's just a short bio, and please feel free to augment that with your own explanation as to your background.
Okay. Well, I've been a student of Native studies since I was a child because I grew up on the west coast of Canada. I actually learned how to carve totem poles and things from Native people, and so it allowed me to become intimate with Native people. I also spent a lot of time in Hawaii and other parts of Polynesia. And I gradually gravitated to Peru about 6 years ago, just drawn by the Inca culture. But since my studies began here, I noticed that there were clearly structures that were far older and far more complicated than could be explained by conventional archaeology.
Okay, great. Well, so what have you found? I mean, what is your, in other words, I'm sure you've done this for many, many years. Maybe you could tell me exactly how many, but if you were to sum up your research to this date, where would you say you're headed in terms of an overall summation?
Well, my basic study started when I was about 8 years old, and so I'm 53, so it's been constant. Being a white person, it's been difficult to, or it was early on, get involved with Native people, but over time, gradually, I've had an acceptance, and now I understand to some degree the Native thought process, and so it's a lot easier for me to engage with Native people and learn from them without, you know, trying to pry into their culture too much. I was just in Easter Island in February and had actually a member of the royal family of Easter Island take me as a guide for 4 days and teach me things that were just mind-boggling.
Okay. Well, yes, I hear you. The second part of that question was where you felt your research had gone, and I'd like to go back and ask you what they've been teaching you in more detail, but first I'd like to get just the second part of the question. So that was just about kind of an overall summary of where you feel where things are leading. In other words, are you going to even Incan cultures at this time? Do you have a scenario for where the elongated skulls came from? Are you one of the people that believe they come from off planet? Is there any kind of trail that you're following now that you would be able to talk about?
Well, the basic timeline that I'm working on now with others is basically the looking for evidence and finding evidence of the great lost civilizations of the past that Graham Hancock has done a lot of work on. So we're looking at structures in South America which are clearly pre the end of the Ice Age, and the skulls show up at megalithic sites. And so there's clearly a link between the megalithic sites and the megalithic builders, and I think the elongated skull people were the megalithic builders. So we're going back at least 10,000, 12,000 years.
Okay. And are you calling them, I don't know, are you calling them descendants of Quetzalcoatl? Are you calling them Anunnaki? Or do you see a link up between those in that group that Sitchin talked about? Or are you aware of, for example, Michael Tellinger and the stone circles in South Africa, et cetera, and that kind of research? Or do you go in a different direction?
Well, I'm aware of all of that, but I'm basing everything that I do on science, and so I have to have evidence to substantiate what I'm talking about. I refuse to speculate very much, but that's where, of course, things like the DNA studies, carbon-14 studies, and that sort of thing fits in. And thanks to working with people such as Chris Dunn, Arlen Andrews, in November I'll be with Robert Schock, and people like that will be able to establish, I think, gradually the fact that ancient, very ancient, sophisticated civilizations existed in Peru and other parts of the world.
Okay, but when it comes to the elongated skulls, you're not one of the people who believes that they were all just shaped that way from childhood, right?
No, definitely. David Hatcher Childress and I just published a book called The Enigma of Cranial Deformation, which we published in February, and that covers the whole subject of how different cultures deformed or altered the shapes of skulls. But we have samples in the Paracas History Museum here, which I've had doctors and other medical people from the U.S. and other countries look at, and they are completely in shock of what they're looking at and refuse to engage with me further.
Oh, really? You mean they come down and they look at all the science you've got going on and then they just walk away?
Basically, they're so dumbfounded that they refuse to comment, and they will not share the information with their colleagues because it's just too unreal for them.
it's just the lack of open minds in science always boggles my mind. Well, you would think that would be the most exciting discovery of their lives, right?
Well, one would think so, but that's why, thankfully, I'm working with people like Lloyd Pye with the Star Child, because, you know, he's been dealing with that for 13 years. So he's very he's very sympathetic to my position, as well as many other people.
Okay. So what are you, I assume you've done some DNA analysis of those skulls, right?
Well, we did initial work about a year ago. I sent samples to Lloyd's geneticist, who's in Texas, and he's been doing all of the work for free. So he hasn't been able to do too much, but what he's done is he's found strands of DNA in the samples that he says doesn't match the global database of humanity, and possibly strands of DNA that don't match anything on the planet. So that's encouraging, but I was actually able to just send Lloyd new samples, which are molar teeth, and so they were just received a few days ago, and Lloyd has just been able to deliver them, and we'll get something much more definitive, we're hoping, within 3 weeks.
Okay. Well, it sounds like your work could use some funding, is that right?
Definitely. The thing is that we basically refuse to engage with governments or major institutions about this because I know for a fact that any results will simply be stolen by them for their own purposes. And so all the funding so far has been by donation. It costs $700 per sample. So if anyone wishes to donate to this project, 100% goes to the DNA and carbon-14 work.
Awesome. Well, this is a very worthy cause, I have to say, one close to my heart because, I have theories about how the Anunnaki are still running the Earth to some degree here, and certainly we are their progeny to some degree as well, and that's a line that you definitely want to follow, according to my whistleblowers. So let me ask you, where do they send, should they go to your website? And I will say that your website is linked right now on the front page of Camelot at the top where you're listed. You know, if they click on the bio, they'll get your website. But if you want to give out any information on how they can contribute, let's get that out of the way right away.
Okay, well, right on the homepage of my website, which is www.hiddeninkatours.com, there is a PayPal donation place, and any donation that I receive, I immediately send an email back to the person thanking them and stating that 100% of the money goes to the DNA research.
Okay, very good. Well, that's wonderful. Let me say that, first of all, are you familiar? I mean, if you're looking into these elongated skulls, how many have you found, first of all, I guess? Let me ask that.
Well, our museum has 40 of them, and there's a museum in Lima which has more than 300, but they are not on display. And that's the weird thing, is that the major collections are in public museums, but they're in storage. But we have 40, and the great thing about our museum is that I open up the glass cases and let people handle these, which no other museum in the world will do.
Well, that's amazing. I don't know why. I thought you were English, but I guess you're not English. It's just that you work with Gary, right? Gary's the PR guy who connected us.
That's true.
Okay. You know, and he connected me with Graham Hancock, and I don't know if you've seen my interview with Graham, but I've also had Graham at my Awake and Aware conference, so I'm very familiar at this point with Graham's work. Stunning guy, and wonderful research. But I just wondered, in terms of sort of the kinds of people that you must be interacting with these skulls and with having them on display the way that you do, I mean, word must be getting out there.
Yeah, it is. And actually, I write articles for Graham. I just wanted to say that I've been a fan of yours and Project Camelot for years. I'm just in complete shock that I'm actually talking to you. It's great. But I was talking to Robert Boval a couple of days ago, and I do know a lot of a lot of major researchers. For some reason, the funding just has been some kind of issue, but we're quite firm in the fact that all of this information that we find out belongs to the 7 billion inhabitants of this planet and not to a little group of people, whether they be governments or whoever. That's my stance.
Okay. I understand you were just Easter Island and you were just shown some things. How does Easter Island even factor in to the elongated skulls? I'm very curious because I could be completely off base here, but my take was that the elongated skulls didn't have anything to do with Easter Island. And am I wrong?
Yeah, I don't want to say you're wrong, but I just wrote a book about the connections between the coast of Peru, Easter Island, Polynesia. And while I was there, I showed pictures of these skulls to my friend who, as I said, is a member of the royal family. Her lineage goes back thousands of years on Easter Island. And she said those people lived on this island as well in the distant past. So the elongated skulls were on Easter Island as well.
Okay, but they're not related to the indigenous people there.
No, that's the whole thing. The story of Easter Island, or Rapa Nui as it's called by the people properly, is very complex in terms of genetics. The Polynesians are probably the last people to live there, or who live there now. But there were other cultures, at least one called the Long Ears, that lived there before. And their genetics, I believe, are from South America and possibly beyond.
Okay. In terms of the Easter Island, you know, carvings, the famous heads, whatever you want to call those, have you been able to crack this, into the mystery of where they came from or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, the most intriguing thing is that there are 200, there are about 900 of them on the island, and none of them are heads. They're actually full bodies. So there are 200 at the quarry. The most famous pictures come from the quarry on Rapa Nui, and they are full bodies. They're basically 30 feet tall, but all you see are the heads because the rest of the bodies are buried.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 200 of them. Yeah, there are 200 of them like that.
Oh, you're kidding me. You mean they've got massive bodies?
Oh, yeah. They have arms and legs and everything.
Underground? And nobody's tried to unearth one?
Well, they did. Actually, Thor Heyerdahl unearthed one, I think, in the 1950s. But then the people of Easter Island told him that it had to be reburied. But my guide, friend, told me that there are, that there isn't one of them. There are 200 plus of them, which are full bodies,
wow,
which is, amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Then they have to be, how tall would they be when they were uncovered?
I think they average about 30 feet.
Okay, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and we're talking to Brian Forrester about these amazing elongated heads, and at the moment about Easter Island and these, what I thought were carved heads, but now I learn that they're part of a huge that's hidden. I guess that makes me extremely naive. Maybe.
There we go. It's I believe we're back on the air now.
Hello, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. Are we live now? If people can hear us?
I'm asking in the chat room right now. We're about a 30-second delay. Yep, we're live.
Okay, does that mean I can talk?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. I understand the whole frickin' station was just thrown off the air. I don't know why or what's going on over there. I don't know if it's storms or, it's just we've been off the air now for five minutes or maybe a little longer. I'm not sure. My guest is Brian Forrester. We're talking about the elongated skulls in Peru, and he's got, I guess, 40 specimens there on display, and there's another, I don't know, sounded like 300, 400 in somewhere not too far away. Where did you say they were located, Brian?
They're in the Archaeological Museum in Lima, but also there are other ones too. There are a number at Tiwanaku in Bolivia, but they were taken off display about a year ago. But I did just discover some in two small museums outside of Cusco. And they're incredible because one of them is massively huge and the other one seems to be about a two-year-old child.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm not understanding what you're saying. You're saying there's about 400, but then you're saying there's two special ones?
No, what I'm saying is that they are in different museums. It's just the museums are not displaying them. So the main collection is in Lima, but also Tiwanaku, which is in Bolivia, which is a very interesting archaeological site. They have a museum that had a number on display, but they took them off display about a year ago. And then there are two small museums outside of Cusco, Peru, that have them on display as well. One of them is a child, elongated skull person who died at about the age of two.
I see. Okay. Was this an elongated skull?
Yes.
So this was naturally elongated at the age of two, right?
That's what we believe, yeah.
Okay. I'm starting to be a little confused here. Okay, it's like kind of wildness out there. First of all, I want to know why we were knocked off the air. I mean, I know that that's maybe, whatever. I don't know if you can even tell me the answer there, but if somebody on my back channel there can tell me who is handling this sort of thing, if Nighthawk's around or whatever, I'd like to know if it was the storm that knocked us off or if we're being messed with, just so I know what I'm dealing with here. But in the meanwhile, as far as these skulls go, I guess, and just to try to pick my train of thought up, we were sort of talking about Easter Island. We were talking about the time when the Easter Island sort of carvings were done, and the fact that those were very, very tall beings, or at least indicated tall beings. And I was saying that I think they had sort of a military look to them. And I didn't have a chance to get your reaction, Brian, on that comment. And then I also wanted to know if they were freestanding. And you started to answer, but I didn't quite get the full answer.
Okay, well, yeah, they're you know, they would have been freestanding people, about 30 feet tall, but they are buried up to their necks at the what's called the quarry site on Rapa Nui. The facial features are very different because they don't look, to some degree, Polynesian. They have long, distended earlobes, which is more like something you find in the Inca culture of Peru than you do in Polynesia. And also, they had top knots on top of their heads, these red top knots, and that indicated that they were red-headed people. They weren't black-haired Polynesian people.
Okay. But don't they have... don't they have like a military helmet on, kind of thing?
Well, no, it's not really a helmet. That is the way that Polynesian people tie their hair up. It's called a top knot. And there are tribal people who still live on Easter Island who have red hair, because Polynesians and South Americans have black hair, or Indians in general have black hair. But this is a very distinct red color. To natural color,
okay,
to the
well
hair.
That's an interesting statement. I mean, that kind of follows, I don't know if that follows along with the Neanderthal theory of Graham Hancock, which if you followed his work, you would know about, right?
Yeah, the thing is, I'm working with a number of people on the red hair. It's more like an auburn, but we're working on that aspect. What we're starting to think is that clearly there was an infusion of people to South America from some other part of the world. They weren't part of the Bering Strait migration of native people. They were probably seafarers that came in the distant past and populated not only Easter Island, but also parts of Polynesia and the coast of Peru.
Okay, my understanding that was Mu.
That could be. That
okay.
Could be the case.
Are you familiar at all with the work of Ashiana Dean?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, her books, the Voyager books, give a completely different history of humanity than is currently taught. And one of the things is they talk about different seedings of humanity, and they explain, different areas of the planet that were seeded with humanity at different times, and when the land masses were in different places, and so on and so forth as well. So there are very many races of beings that are involved in seeding mankind repetitively. And at any rate, it's a very interesting couple of books, and highly recommend that information. Although if you try to be quasi-scientific in your approach, unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of respect for so-called science as they have it construed on the planet at this time. But be that as it may, I understand a lot of people do. So, but you may find this questionable, but it is physicists are following her work because the science in it is actually groundbreaking. So it looks like we've got just a report on being thrown off the air. They don't want you to hear this as usual, my show. So they knocked our whole show off and has nothing to do with a storm, just so you understand that. Now, okay, well, this is very interesting. I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave Easter Island with you here, and we're going to have to go back to these elongated skulls where they are concentrated. And I just want to ask you what your thought is in terms of, first of all, the height of the beings that held, had such a skull, and whether or not the skulls are all from people of the same height or approximate, you know, time on Earth, or if they came from different generations or different eons or whatever you think.
Okay, well, actually, I just want to say that I am taking a scientific stance, but I'm also highly intuitive, so I'm dealing with this with both left and right brains together. It's just okay. I think it's good to have factual evidence as well as intuition, because that's a whole-brained approach. What we're looking at is, according to, you know, and, you know, I battle conventional archaeology all the time because they... You know, they live in a box, and I refuse to live in a box. But what they say is that the Paracas people with the elongated heads lived, or they died out 2,000 years ago. But they can't tell us how far back in time they go. And that's part of the research I'm doing through the DNA, et cetera, is to find out how far back in time this could have been that these people lived in that area, as well as other parts of South America, and actually around the world.
Okay. I guess what I was asking, and I don't know if you quite understood my question, but what I was trying to say is, assuming you have 40 of them, skulls, right? I wondered if they all came from the same sort of time and place, or whether some of them, I mean, I guess this would assume that you'd have them aged, and or, you know, figured out their age or their approximate time. You know what I'm saying? In other words, have you got any idea, did they all originate from the same group of people? Were they related? Do they have the same, you know, did they all appear on the earth around the same time, or did they come from different, whole different generations, or even, you know, hundreds of years difference?
Well, the basic idea is that there are five different shapes of skulls that we have, and they're dramatically different. I guess you could say from this, in terms of scale, from ones that look like they've been flattened to some degree to ones that are true cone heads, like Dan Aykroyd's depiction on Saturday Night Live. So there's a broad range of different people. In terms of time frame, what I'm saying is minimum 2,000 years old, but we don't know maximum until we get the carbon-14 testing done. But that's, you know, quite intriguing. The largest skulls in the world are found in Paracas.
Okay. Okay. Sorry for the hesitation here. I'm getting a message that my site may be down as well. It's just so bizarre that that they would just be so concerned over this. I don't know why they have nothing better to do with themselves than try to keep the truth from people. It's just amazing to me they want to keep people so dumbed down. And we just have evidence every day of Camelot being messed with just repeatedly. And if people don't think that I'm busting my ass over here to get the truth out in every way, and I, you know, when I reach this kind of when I get an obstacle, just so you know, I'm the kind of person who you put an obstacle in my way and then I just want to go there all the more. That's just one of my personality traits. Okay. Well, so you did answer the question. Maybe you just answered it a little more scientifically when you said that they were five different types, meaning it's possible they all lived at different times as well, right?
Yeah, it's possible either that they lived at different times or that they were five different social classes, from people who their heads were deformed on purpose in some cases, and in other cases they may have been born that way. So that's what I'm trying to distinguish between, is those that were cranially deformed as a ceremonial thing and those that were born with elongated skulls.
Okay, well, allow me to be so bold as to say that, first of all, I assume you have some skulls which it's unequivocal, just as you said, those scientists are walking away, not wanting to pursue it, goes against all their, it doesn't go against their skull because somebody tried to deform their skull and got to some level like like that, but rather because they were born that way and it was natural. It's the natural ones that we're really interested in, not the ones that tried to deform themselves to look like those people, because that indicates a whole different racial line, and which what is known as, at least in the Sitchin world, as the Anunnaki. And I have a particular interest in that because of being Camelot, and evidence that I have that those individuals are still walking the planet at times, and also certainly on Mars and on space stations and so on, orchestrating some things even, I'm told, from the fourth dimension. So that being the case, what I'm interested in is what I would say about the deformed ones is that's just the normal kind of thing when people worship so-called gods or what they call royalty or anyone who, you know, appears to be so-called, superior to them or acts superior to them or is made to them to think that they are superior, then obviously the social class thing steps in and the other ones get oppressed for various things in rank and so on and so gets interfered with. So then obviously if you had a child, you would try to make the child look as much like the ruling class as they do now, following customs and so on and so forth. Because if you can pass as a member of the ruling class, you're much more likely to get society's benefits. It just stands to reason.
That's exactly it, and well done, because most people don't get that, but that's exactly the pattern that I'm following. The cranial deformation seems to be a way to replicate those that lived farther in the past, and it's only the royal people who had the elongated skull. So that's why we do have a few examples of ones that appear to be completely natural, because they're far too complicated in shape for someone to cradle board or try to manipulate. They look like they were born with this enormous cone head, which is at least 25% larger in cranial capacity than contemporary skulls.
Do we lose you, Carrie?
Sorry, no, you didn't. I was trying to get my engineer to realize anyway, that our site might be down. Okay, well, I'm very happy to hear that, you've gone along those lines. That's great. I would also like to suggest that there might be, I don't know if you've considered this, and it's quite possible you have, which is, that they will also, the idea of royalty, ruling, and also spiritual authority will go along the lines of these elongated heads, since they would be the ones in control. And therefore, elongating heads, by the parents when the children are born would also be a sort of wishful thinking, if you will, that maybe by doing so, they would track a certain amount of spiritual knowledge in the process to the child. Simply in sort of emulating these other so-called spiritual and royal masters of theirs. Interesting dynamic, but have you considered that?
Oh, definitely. I think that's exactly the case. I think what happened was that the population of naturally elongated skull people was small because, as you said, they were the ruling class. And so as they mixed with so-called normal humans, over time, the elongation would start to disappear and the shape of the skull would start to change over generations to become more normal looking. And that was dangerous or scary to them. And so that's why the cranial manipulation began, to try to replicate the look of the ancient ancestors who were the spiritual, intellectual masters.
Exactly. Well, very good. Okay. Well, at this point, okay, well, this is Carrie Kapp from Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and I'm just getting really aggravated at these people trying to mess with my website and my radio show when I'm trying to get the truth out over here. We are talking to Brian Forster about the elongated Anunnaki, very likely Anunnaki heads, call them what you will. In fact, I was just asking you before the break about the work of Zachariah Sitchin and whether or not you had followed it at all, and what your thought was, and also whether or not you had ever met him.
I never met him. I have studied some of his work, and I definitely, you know, believe that there has been alien contact with Earth and that we are descendants from other star systems. And I think that the elongated skulls, and, you know, this is moving away from my scientific look, but I think that we are looking at alien-human hybrids, possibly.
Okay. In other words, you think the naturally elongated skulls are alien-human hybrids?
I think that they're the descendants of a mix, of a very intriguing racial mix between this world and either a lost human civilization or a lost civilization from off-planet.
Okay. Well, interesting. Yes, I mean, to some degree, I guess you could call it that. I mean, I have sort of a different way of phrasing it, but that's okay. I mean, it's kind of like however you want to go at them. We have some people, by the way, working on getting our site back up, and we are trying to get the show out there. So I don't know if people are being sent away in droves or whether, you know, our audience is hearing this or not, but hopefully we can maintain here. What the thing is that, you know, I actually had a conversation with Graham. I don't know. Do you know Graham well?
I can't say I know him well. I communicate with him.
Okay. Well, he and I had sort of a you might say, a tete-a-tete over this subject. So I just was curious whether or not you followed his point of view on it. And it sounds like perhaps you don't necessarily, but what we talked about and what was really interesting to me is that he didn't really want to go in that direction. You know, I've spent several years going to Egypt, and I'm actually going back around December 21st, 2012. And if you look at the carvings and the skeletons there, they have some of them have elongated heads, and certainly Akhenaten and Nefertiti apparently come from a bloodline like that, and there are mixed points of view about that, and a lot of the carvings will show those beings, I mean, all over the place, and they are always enlarged. They are larger than what are humans that can be, you know, drawn or carved standing right next door to those beings, and yet what I got was that Graham didn't really want to go into the land of understanding that those were indeed Anunnaki and that they were ruling and that the others were the humans, but they were not the other, you know, the Anunnaki were a different race. So I don't know if you're aware, have you been to Egypt and seen all of that?
No, I'm going in April of next year with Stephen Mailer.
Oh, my God. So you haven't... You're kidding me. You really?
Well, and that's also why I don't talk too much about the Amarna family, because I haven't physically been to Egypt.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's a trip. You know, I also went with Carmen Balta back in a couple years ago in 2010. We did go to Amarna, by the way, at that time. Amarna is has been decimated, of course, by what I would say is a nuclear bomb, but other people may disagree. And I have past life recall there that's really intense, and I can see actually the earlier civilization in my mind's eye, if you will. When I'm there, I bilocate. And it's quite fascinating what goes on. But when I was there, I had a very intense dream, which wasn't like a dream at all. It was like I was there with the royal family. It's quite bizarre. So I have quite a bit of, I don't know, whatever you want to call, overlay of that. It's quite fascinating. I am taking a group in, as I said, in December to be in the Great Pyramid. and all in that area, although we won't be going to Amarna. Amarna is a tragic, tragic place. The energy is, you know, well, if you have the overlay that I have, very hard to deal with on an emotional level, what happened with regard to all of that. But, yeah, I mean, I would say it would augment your work greatly because obviously you're dealing with some beings that are related to this sort of family line, it appears to me, or at least a racial line.
Yeah, that could very well be true. I've done some research about the Amarnas, and that it's possible that the cranial elongation amongst them came from the Mitanni culture of the Middle East.
Uh-huh. And who is the Mitanni culture?
They were quite a powerful culture. Nefertiti came from.
Uh huh. And okay. And that is based on what information?
That's based on any information you can find on the internet about that from conventional archaeological sources.
I see. Okay. Well, I probably would take issue with that, but I've never heard so much of it referred to in that way. So I don't think that, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, go along those lines necessarily. Somebody's telling me I sound too loud, so I'm going to turn this lower.
Brian's on a mic and a desk speakers, I think, and his desk speaker's up a little loud.
Okay. Are you seeing my speakers or are you seeing the Brian's?
Whoever's on got the desk speakers going, that's the one that's a little too loud. Just turn the speaker down.
Well, one's a female voice and one's a male voice. Can you make a distinction between which one?
I'm getting both of them.
Okay.
That sounds good on you now, if Brian can say something.
Okay.
It's coming through yours, Carrie.
It was me. Okay,
yes,
fine.
Yeah. Just turn your speakers down just a little bit.
I can go lower as well. And there you go. Okay, thank you for telling me. You know, we never know what's going to go on here. Okay, well, now, just as far as these skulls, you haven't, it appears, I mean, you've been working on this for years, right? And you have 40 skulls, but not all of them are normal, or, I mean, sorry, natural. And, I mean, would you say that your progress is slow, or what would you say is going on with all of that?
Well, what I would say is progress has been kind of slow because of the lack of funding. I'm financing most of this myself, and that's not clearly going to be something I can do in the long term. But I'm regarded as being one of the world experts on this subject, even though it's still in its infancy. But we're progressing quite well. The DNA and carbon-14 testing will be huge once we get more funding for it.
Yeah, it just seems amazing to me that with all the money in the world, this seems to be something where, of course, I'm sure in black projects they've done all this testing already and they have all the answers, but it does seem like that there would be even wealthy sort of entrepreneurs out there who would be fascinated by all of this, who then would want to help you out. I guess part of it may be getting the word out that you are doing this, and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
Okay. We do have a chat room, by the way, and unfortunately, I think our chat room is down. I think Revolution Radio has a chat room as well. So I don't know if people are trying to ask questions in the background, and I don't know if they want to ask questions, but if they do and they want to call in, I think that there's a means by which they can do that. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. If you want me to accept calls, I will.
Yes, we should. We're on the last hour of the show, although we have had some interruptions here, and I would like to give people that opportunity to call in and ask you some questions, Brian. But is there some background other than, you know, that, I mean, you're obviously taking over this museum, you're sort of safeguarding and you're spearheading the investigation into all of this. Is there anything else you want to tell us about your discoveries thus far?
Well, basically, the thing is that this was a global phenomenon. It happened, there are elongated skulls that have been found from ancient Iraq, from the island of Malta, Melanesia, Peru, amongst the Olmecs, and other ancient cultures as well. Wherever you find megalithic structures of great antiquity, you seem to find these skulls. And I think that the megalithic builders were the elongated skull people, descendants from very mysterious, you know, bloodline. But I can't comment too much about the bloodline until we have the DNA testing underway properly.
Okay. Well, yes, and I understand that, and I appreciate that you're a diligent researcher. I do have someone giving me a phone number where people can call in, and I am told my chat is now up. So the Project Camelot chat room is now back up. The phone number they can call in on is 347-688-2902. That's, I believe it probably is on the front page of freedomslip.com somewhere for callers. But at any rate, if you wanted that number. All right.
We've been joined by a caller.
Okay, you're saying we have a caller?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you want to let them on the air here with us?
They are.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I'm just a little rusty on how this procedure goes. But at any rate, this is Carrie Cassidy and Brian Forrester, and you're on the air. Hello?
The unknown caller, you're on the air.
Okay, maybe they weren't prepared to actually get on the air. That's okay. We're just going to continue here. Brian, what I wanted to say to you was, in terms of your experience, do you have, for example, because you're obviously dedicating your life to this, and you say you're an intuitive, do you have dreams, for example, that have given you or revealed information to you, led you down a certain path?
Well, it's mainly because I'm in contact with the skulls, and I photograph them and I hold them, that they seem to have chosen me to be one of the people to protect them from being exploited or being suppressed. And so that very deeply emotionally is my sense about them, is that they want their knowledge and their history to be known, and they've chosen me as one of the people to tell the world about who they were, where they came from, how they lived, and what they have to teach us.
Okay. But as far as getting sort of what I would call downloads and or visions of information from them, you don't have anything to reveal in that regard?
Not really. I'm being taught incrementally as time goes. I'm led to certain places, and information is revealed to me gradually. There's nothing, you know, no major downloads have happened, but it's a gradual process of uncovering that which has not been even, you know, the last archaeologist to barely look at this was in 1928. Nobody else has done any research about the Peru skull since then, which is weird.
When you say, okay, no one has done any research since then, what do you mean about, I'm not understanding what you're saying. Nobody has done any research since then.
Okay, well, no one has really studied the Paracas culture since 1928, and that was a famous Peruvian archaeologist called Julio Teo, but he didn't even really mention much about the elongated skulls themselves. He was more interested in their textiles and pottery. Like, he was a very, you know, he was a real archaeologist that way. So no one has really looked at the elongated skull phenomenon here very much since I came on the scene. And it, you know, it's kind of a weird feeling for me, but I'm very privileged in that position.
Okay. And did you get that there eight years ago?
No, I started studying in Peru about 6 years ago, and it's because I found evidence of elongated skulls supposedly amongst the Inca that that's when my interest began, because I was studying the Inca and writing books about them. Then I also found them in photographs from Tiwanaku, which is where the Inca came from, and then on the coast of Peru here as well, all of a sudden there are all these skulls at my disposal, but that I can analyze here. And the funny thing is that I can literally walk down the street of the town of Paracas with one, and the local people don't care. In any other country, you know, the police would be there or something, but people here just don't care about the.
Okay, but the skulls, as far as discovering the skulls, I mean, you didn't dig them out of the ground, I take it.
No, ethically, I won't do that. I know of five graveyards, ancient graveyards, where they are buried, but it's because huaqueros, who are grave robbers, find them. They're not looking for the skulls. They're looking for pottery, gold, and textiles. And so the skulls are found because they're the royal people, and the royal people are always buried with the best stuff. So the skulls show up at the museum simply because local people find them and either, in general, just donate them to the museum.
We have a caller on the hold.
Oh, hello?
Hi, caller. You're talking to Carrie Cassidy and Brian Forrester.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Oh, hi. Yes. How are you guys doing? I would like to share one of my experiences I've had with one of these beings with the long skulls.
Okay.
Yeah, it was around, and I'm not lying. I'm not lying at all. This really did happen, and I wasn't in no drugs. I'm not crazy. This happened during Christmas time, 2010, and I was in my living room and I was meditating, and I went in deep meditation. And then during that time, I was interested in technology. I was asking, like, where did technology come from? Like, the origins of this technology and mathematics and all that. So I was meditating, and then I saw myself traveling through a tunnel in my mind, and I was asking those questions: Where did technology originate and mathematics? And all of a sudden, I saw a vision of a Greek man writing these weird cryptic myth like writings on a wall, and then I heard a voice say, like a soft voice, that said that it is sacred knowledge. So I freaked out and I opened my eyes, and there I saw that being across the living room. He was just standing there, like staring at me, as if they somehow detected me meditating and asking these questions, and then it came down to visit me to see like who was doing the meditation. It was like observing me, and then I noticed there was that one with the long skull, and it was just staring. It was just standing there, but it was cloaked. It was like a ghost. It was all like see through, but I could still see like its outlines. So I knew it was that, and it had a big skull, like the ones you see like on the internet. And it had a cape as well. He had like a robe, like a kind of some type of cape robe on him. And next to him was like this little tiny one, like this little tiny little alien. And this little alien was just like curious. It was like just looking at me like as if it never seen a human being before. It was just like looking at me with awe. So I freaked out. So I ran outside into my front yard. And I opened the door and I walked out of the door, out of the house, these two really tall beings, like they somehow, like they saw me leaving, so they like walked, like they kind of rushed towards me, like as if they didn't want me to leave, like they were guarding the front house. And they also had robes over them. It was like these capes covering their bodies, but they were really tall and they were like cloaked as well. So I knew who they were. I knew who they were and what they were doing. So I stood outside. I was just staring outside, just looking around in the sky, and it was like nighttime. And then above, I seen a huge dark gray cloud above my atmosphere, and I just sensed something heavy, something dense above. So I was thinking, oh, it's probably their ship. So I just felt like, okay. So I just ran back inside my house, and then I just grabbed my swords, my katanas, and then I just stood there like in the living room, just waiting to see what they were doing. That's why I got my sword.
Okay.
Because this is like one of many different encounters I had with the Greys.
I see. Okay. Well, listen, caller. Thank you very much for calling in. Okay.
Yeah, but I swear to God,
I'm going to let you go here.
Carrie, this is not a lie. It is.
Yep, I hear you. Well, I've had an encounter myself with an Anunnaki, very tall being, very, very tall. So I understand where you're coming from. Thank you for your call. Okay, Brian, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Brian. So I am curious because here you are walking around Caracas. You're the only guy since 1928 who's been really interested in all of this, which I find really hard to believe. Maybe I would phrase it differently. I would say there are some other researchers who do seem to be investigating the elongated skulls in other countries, but you're saying you're the only one in Caracas, I guess, right?
Yeah, in Paracas. I've been in contact with other people. I can't remember his name, the man in Malta. I think his name is Forgione, but I wrote an article for his Italian magazine about them. I've written a number of articles about them. But in terms of conventional research, my sister is a doctor, and I sent photographs to her, you know, to send to her medical community, and she just received no interest in having anatomists or anybody study these. And it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm getting used to it.
Yeah, but, it was fascinating. I'm just curious, do you try to take, I don't know if it's possible, can you take like a skull and go on a speaking tour at all?
Well, no, it's illegal to take them out of the country because they're pre-Columbian, and nothing pre-Columbian is allowed out of Peru without major paperwork, and it's just it's too much of a pain in the neck to try to go through that process. So that's why I'm doing it through the internet, because that way I can do, you know, video, photos, right, you know, articles, and you know, I can get DNA to people.
I mean, you can certainly go on tour though, doing a speaking tour with the skulls. I mean, in terms of photographs and so on.
Yeah, I just came back from England where I was working with Hugh Newman of Megalithomania. I spent a month
great
in England giving talks, and
people were simply
blown away by the whole thing. But, you know, for me, it's a very long-term process. And
Met Michael Tellinger?
No, not yet. I was I'd very much like to meet Michael because, you know, his story is very intriguing. So I look forward to the opportunity. I met Klaus Dohna in England.
Oh, great. Yeah, Klaus is fabulous. Well, let me ask you this, you haven't been, obviously, if you haven't met Michael, you haven't also been to Adam's Calendar, where the amazing stones are, and the idea that he has, which is of what he calls Enki's house and Enki's lab and all this kind of thing, and the stone circles. But those beings, being the Anunnaki that Sitchin talked about, is how Michael views it. And there's tremendous energy, let me say, at Adam's Calendar. And in fact, when I was recently there, they were trying to ban people from even getting into Adam's Calendar anymore. And I don't know what's happened with that since then, but it's a very dark, foreboding sort of turn of events in South Africa if they don't allow people into Adam's Calendar, because that's one of the top. It's probably one of the top power places on the planet, but it's totally undiscovered by most people at this time. It is in the same lineup with I believe Stonehenge and the Great Pyramid. So, which I think is like what they call the 37th or 38th or 36th parallel, one of those. it's an experience you don't want to not have, especially if you're having interactions with these elongated skulls. In terms of your information about, I don't know where you go when you just when you study a skull. You know what I'm saying? In other words, are you just also studying, like an archaeologist, with the settlements, the things that came with the skull, in order to get information about how they lived?
Oh, exactly. No, definitely. We do have examples of their pottery, and we know that they had the potter's wheel more than 2,000 years ago. They were trading with people in the Amazon because we found feathers. From your much earlier question, these people average 6 feet tall, both men and women, which doesn't sound like giants, but when you take into account that the Inca averaged about 5'3", 600 years ago, these people would have been regarded as being giants.
Okay. Are you sure that that's as tall as they got?
No, I've only got 12 samples so far. I'm using the femur bone because from the femur you can extrapolate to the height of a person. But that's the sample size I have so far. They may have been larger. And through people like Lloyd Pye and others, we're going to start doing things like facial reconstruction. And a friend of mine who's a great artist called Mark LaPlume is doing drawings of his interpretations of what he thinks their faces look like, because they don't look typical, Indian of this area. They look like a mix of different races.
Uh-huh. Well, are you able to direct people to those drawings?
Yeah, actually, I just made a YouTube video yesterday with a number of Mark's drawings, and they're available, or that video is available on my video website, which is hiddenincavideos.com.
Okay, could you send that to me after we get off the air here so that I can post it also to the radio show link, which will be on my site, long after the show is over. We're trying to keep a bio of the guest and link, important links on his page. And also so I can post it for people to, I'll actually post it on the website so people can become aware of it if you'd like.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. I'm very interested in getting information on the subject out there, as I'm sure Gary knew, and it's why he put us into contact, I'm sure. So if you were to sort of talk about these beings, it sounds like you don't believe them to be physiologically like the beings that were traditionally known as indigenous peoples to the area, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'm starting to think that even the Royal Inca family may have been this kind of person, because there are no drawings or sculptures of Inca prior to the arrival of the Spanish. So I do have sculptures, like little bronze sculptures from the Tiwanaku, Bolivia area, that portray people having elongated skulls. And these is 2,000 years old.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I don't understand. Maybe you could explain to me, what is the relationship between the Inca and the elongated skulls beings?
Well, the thing is that the Inca supposedly came from Lake Titicaca, supposedly from Tiwanaku, about 1,000 years ago. And Tiwanaku is incredibly sophisticated in terms of the technology that must have been used to build it. That's why I'm going with Christopher Dunn, who wrote the book, The Giza Power Plant. We're going in August. There are stone constructions at Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, which clearly indicate that thousands of years ago, people had machine technology to do the construction work. So if the Incas are descendants of those people, and the Inca were incredibly intelligent, and I don't just mean human intelligent, I mean super intelligent beings, if they are descended from that area, then they would have very amazing intellectual skill, and that's why they were able to create their civilization and expand so rapidly. they weren't, compared to what most people say about the Inca, they weren't warlike. They were more conciliatory in the way that they expanded their culture. They used force when they had to, but too many archaeologists portray the Inca as a warlike tribal people, and they were in no way that in that way.
Okay, but you're not talking about the Inca because you're not classifying this group as Inca, correct?
No, what I'm saying is that I think the Inca are descended from very special people, and since elongated skulls have been found at sacred sites of the Inca, I think that the Inca were descendants of an elongated skulled race.
Okay, is there any biological reason to believe that?
Yeah, because the skulls exist in and around Cusco, in these small museums.
Right, but what I meant is, in other words, just because you find two people's remnants in the same place does not mean there's a link-up between those two people. I mean, you know, yes, it's circumstantial evidence of a relationship between. It doesn't mean there's a blood relationship. In other words, it doesn't mean they're from the same biological pool.
Well, that's correct, but that's why I have to get DNA samples from the skulls in the Cusco area and have the DNA analyzed and compare those with the Paracas people and see if there is a relationship or not.
Okay, because I would suggest, I mean, this is just me, that rather than think that they actually had an interrelationship, sort of sexually speaking, that they may indeed just were there and that the one was ruling the other race, but that they didn't necessarily intermix. Isn't that possible?
Yeah, that is possible.
Okay, now if that were possible, I mean, I'm just going down this road and you can follow it and see what you think about, you know, and I'm happy to hear pros and cons on both sides. Let's say that there were two races, one of which had elongated skulls and one of which had sort of normal indigenous human skulls. And then those two races, you wanted to prove that they intermingled. And the way you would prove that, it seems to me, aside from, you know, DNA studies, which we don't always get to have, might be a progression of skulls that changed from being elongated to gradually more and more, less and less elongated in a natural progression where each skull generation then had a little less of the, you know, protrusion or whatever you want to call it type of thing. So that one type of skull, maybe partially because, and I don't know this, but it may be that in terms of our gravity, that having a skull that's super elongated is not as sort of conducive in this gravity as it might be in another gravity. You know what I'm saying? So have you seen an evidence of a progression of skulls in the skulls that you have to where, and I'm not talking about when they alter this purposely, I'm talking about a natural where the kid was born and he had a certain shape of skull. Is there any kind of natural progression in which it goes from elongated to non-elongated?
Yeah, well, definitely. Up until, you know, actually what we're looking at is a progression from the natural shape to where the cranial deformation was imposed on the people. And again, I believe that's because the population of the original elongated skull people was small to start with, and as they intermixed with so-called normal humans, the elongation began to disappear, and so it was imposed upon the ruling children to have their skulls bound in order to look like the ancestors, because these people, I think, were afraid that the, you know, intelligent ancestors were disappearing amongst them. That's why we have a graduation in the five different types that we have in the museum here.
Okay. Is it also, I mean, there's kind of like a number of different interpretations of all of this. So if there's also the chance that actually that's not what was happening, That's an assumption that the elongated skulls were in fact disappearing, when in fact they might have just gone off planet. I mean, if they came from off planet and they went on, they may not be indigenous to here, so they wouldn't necessarily, like I said, there may have been other reasons, biological, for example, why they couldn't stay for an extended period of time. So that the ones that they interbred with were more hybrids already. In other words, that they created a hybrid race out of their group with elongated skulls and the indigenous people, just as was done. Well, this is Adam's calendar. This is what Michael Tellinger talks about, as was done during the days of the Anunnaki in Africa, which again is written about in the Sumerian tablets, where they are really affecting a certain DNA of the humans, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a whole process that went on in that regard.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, but you know what I'm saying is that if we're looking at the megalithic builders, we're probably looking at a time frame of those constructions in Peru and Bolivia at being probably more than 10,000 years ago. So if you think about a generation being 20 or 25 years, that's a lot of generations between a time span of 10,000 or 12,000 years ago up to the disappearance of the elongation process itself 2,000 years ago. Because after that, the elongated skulls disappear completely, whether they're natural or deformed on purpose. After 2,000, or more recent than 2,000 years ago, all you have are normal-looking people.
That is another very interesting dynamic. Just out of curiosity, though, in terms of, you know, when you look back at history, like one of the major events in terms of cataclysms, I believe, was at the 10,000 mark, right?
Yeah, 10,000 BC, more or less.
Okay, and then was there anything that happened around 2,000 BC, or whenever you say these skulls disappeared? Is there anything in the historical record that marks their disappearance?
No, some people speculate that about 5,000 years ago there was a major event, but you know, based on the work of Graham Hancock and others, including Barbara Hand Clough, it sounds like somewhere in the region of 9,000 BC or 11,000 BC, at the ending of the Ice Age, which was a catastrophic event. It wasn't like this gentle melting of the poles. It may have altered the tilt of the Earth, the axis of the Earth, and everything. And so that's why, you know, people speculate, like Graham, that cities are underwater, because you know most high civilizations would have lived by the ocean. And so since the water level of the entire world rose by between 300 and 400 feet several thousand years ago as the result of the end of the Ice Age, most high global cultures' remains are underwater. It's just interesting that up around Cusco and where I'm at, which happens to be at sea level, we find these intriguing remains of people that conventional science doesn't want to look at.
Okay, but of course you're not able at this time to test to see what age they really are. But again, you're saying that these skulls disappeared around the year 2000 BC, right?
No, 2,000 years ago, about the time of Christ.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, but there's no, in other words, there's no event that can be pointed to around that exact time. But you feel there's evidence that up to then they did exist. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, what happened here in the Paracas area is that the Nazca people, famous for the Nazca lines, they moved into this territory because the Paracas covered the entire area of where Nazca is and beyond. They were a huge culture governed by this very small royal family of elongated skulls. But intermixing would have happened with the Nazca as they moved in. And 2,000 years ago, in the archaeological record of the area, the elongated skulls disappear and the rise of the Nazca happens.
Oh, we're back.
Okay. Can I be heard now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I guess we're knocked off the air temporarily right there. What I wanted to say about that is that the these elongated heads people, it seems to me that they came from off planet. There's plenty of evidence they came from off planet, and that those animals that you see from the air can't be seen any other way except from the air, so that they had to be built by an air-faring civilization, it seems to me. I don't think that's a leap. What do you think?
No, that's absolutely correct. The lines are not mysterious because the lines can be made from the ground. I've been to Nazca many times. You can see the lines just by walking around. But the animal figures, you can only see from the air. And like what I said, the lines cut straight through the animal figures as though the makers of the lines didn't know that the animals were there. And that's why And Senior Juan Navarro, who's the director of the museum, believed that the animal figures are Paracas culture, the mysterious Paracas culture, who existed earlier in Nazca. You know.
Okay, why do you call it, just a curiosity, why are you calling it the Paracas culture?
Well, it's just that that's what archaeologists call these people. They covered quite a vast territory from the ocean up into the highlands of Peru and south through the whole Nazca area. Nazca is about 4 hours drive from where I am, and I'm 4 hours south of Lima. So that's what archaeologists call, you know, have labeled these people, the Paracas culture. It was
okay,
only.
But the Paracas culture, is that the elongated heads culture that you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They're the red-headed elongated skull people.
Okay. And so why is it that you think the elongated skulls had red hair?
They obviously had genetic input from elsewhere. People too easily speculate that they, you know, were, you know, Celtic people, which I don't believe. I think they're a lost period of human history, and where their, you know, red hair comes from, it could be from Sitchin's, you know, Middle Eastern area. I'm not sure.
Okay, but I guess what I was trying to say is, how does the evidence of red hair, if you haven't been able to do the DNA sampling, where did even the idea that they had red hair come from?
Because we have mummified skulls that have red hair.
Oh. And those mummified skulls are elongated?
Yes.
Are they naturally elongated?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. So that's quite interesting. And one assumes that if you have red hair, you have blue eyes. Is that correct as well?
That I'm not sure. And unfortunately, you know, the mummified heads that we have, you know, the eye is very, very soft, you know, liquid tissue, so it disappears. Hair is, you know, keratin, so it lasts a long
right.
time.
Right. Is there any artistic evidence of paintings or drawings of these people?
Yeah, there is, and actually we have fabrics that show animal figures very similar to the Nazca lines made by the Paracas people.
Okay, but do you have figures drawn of these people themselves with the elongated heads?
No, we have stone artifacts that are like mock-ups of what they looked like, but the Paracas, They were artistic, but it was actually in their fabrics and textiles, which are very almost like acid trip things. They were quite intriguing. They had an obsession with snakes and with cats for some reason.
Okay, yeah, just very Egyptian. But you don't see pictures of them.
No, that's the weird thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Very interesting. Gosh, what about a monatomic gold or gold? Does gold crop up in and around them at all?
Well, that's quite an amazing thing because, of course, the Andes are, you know, have huge deposits of gold, but at least the Paracas people had very little in terms of metals, and I don't understand why, but some gold artifacts have been found. Very strange-looking shapes, but nothing in great volume.
Okay, is there? You keep calling them the Paracas people, and I'm just interested why. In other words, the elongated heads. You're actually referring to them as though they were a tribe of people, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, they were a civilization of people.
Okay. And yet the evidence of actual skulls that are elongated naturally, how much evidence of that is there? Other than you've got 40 skulls, or the 40 you've got, I don't know how many are naturally elongated.
We have about, I think, we have between 5 and 6 which are natural.
Okay, and then if you say there's nearby, there was that place that has 400?
Yeah, and there's also another museum about an hour's drive away at Ica. And if anyone looks in a search engine for a photo of an elongated skull or alien skull, they will see this one specific picture, and that's from the Ica Museum of this massive elongated skull which exists there, and that is from, again, the Paracas culture.
Okay, what do you mean by of this massive elongated skull? Different than other skulls?
Yeah, I can only speculate, but I think the cranial volume of that skull is about 2 liters, whereas you and I have a volume of, I believe, about 1.2. So that's quite, you know, the brain was
but
a lot larger.
Isn't it bigger than all the other skulls?
That one is. We have one example which I was finally able to get hold of, where the brain was at least 25% larger than any of the other ones that we have.
Very possible they come from a completely different place in line?
It is possible. This one stands out amongst all the others. It was found in a graveyard with other elongated skulls, but it's very different, very special.
Yeah, I think I perhaps have seen it. Okay, well, I mean, it is a fascinating study. I guess you agree, and it's wonderful that you're dedicating yourself to this. I want to commend you on that, because I think someone has got to do this research, and obviously they're very afraid to do it. Have you ever talked to Michael Cremo?
Yeah, I when I was in England, I stayed in the same bed and breakfast as Michael Cremo. I had great chats with him.
Did you compare notes at all?
Yeah, man. Michael's intrigued with what I he sat down and listened to my talk.
Okay, very good. Well, I mean, let me just say that Camelot is open to your research at any time. So if you come up with stuff, please do contact me in the future, and I'll be happy to, you know, put it on my website, get it out there, and make people aware of what you're doing and your success. I also encourage you to, do some kind of banner exchange, and that way we can encourage people to go to your website and support your work.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you.
Yeah, please get in touch with me about organizing that. Well, it's a delight to know that you're out there doing this work. Is there anything that you've come across in sort of investigating all of this that's we haven't mentioned here, that you wrote into your book, or you know, there's things or anything that you think we should be aware of that we haven't talked about, because we've only got, you know, about 10 minutes left of the show?
Well, I think one thing that's important is that the Olmec people are very important, because examples of elongated skulls have been found amongst them. And from what I've learned, it's very possible or even probable that the Mayan calendar is not Mayan, it's Olmec. The Olmecs were an older culture. And so the problem is that because of where the Olmec lived, the ground is, you know, it's more like a tropical environment. And so things like bones and skulls don't last in the soil there as much as here, because here it's complete desert. But examples have been found, and it's, you know, it is possible through migration on the ocean, etc., that the Olmec and the Paracas are or were related people. So, you know, my investigations obviously are continuing. I'm looking forward to going to Egypt in April of next year with Stephen Mailer so that I can look, you know, so that I can physically look at Tutankhamun and see if I think he had an elongated skull or not. Akhenaten's mummy has never been found. Nefertiti's mummy has never been found. So Tutankhamun is the only one we really have of the Mitanni family, so, or of the Amarna family.
Okay,
so
but
far.
There are a huge number of statues that have been carved, but of course that's not archaeological evidence in that same sense. Let me see what I was going to ask you. You know, I'm confused about that, the Olmec link up that you're talking about again. I don't mean to presume that I know anything more than about this, really, than not even close to what you know, for example. But I did study this art quite a number of years ago, and the Olmec heads, you know, I've seen them up close, and they're these stunning, very fat, helmeted heads again. And I don't know if you're going to tell me that's not a helmet, but I still think it is. But at any rate, they look like sumo wrestlers. And I cannot believe that you're telling me that the Olmecs are, you think, come from this Paracas race of elongated heads.
No, I'm just saying that I've seen photographs, and there are very few of them because there are very few skulls, but there are elongated, or there were elongated people amongst the Olmec. Of course, most of the sculptures look like they're African or Chinese or something, but at least a few skulls have been found which have the same kind of features as the Paracas. I'm not saying they're physically related. I'm just saying it's intriguing through the book that I wrote with David Childress that, you know, we find amongst many advanced ancient civilizations these elongated skulls. Whether they're related or not is too early to tell.
Well, I mean, of course, with my information would be that if they're rulers, then, of course, from time to time they do, you know, crop up, visit their, you know, minions, so to speak, regardless of where they are, et cetera. And some of them may be installed living with them or among them, even temporarily at times. This seems to be the case. But, it is a fascinating sort of story that we have yet to understand or unfold, just no doubt about it. I've often thought that Olmec race to be completely different group of people, and I would expect to be vastly different genetically from almost all the other races, including the Incas and the Aztecs, etc. Their physiology just seems to be so different. I don't know how they could even be related. And I do understand the whole notion, you know, of this jaguar mouth that was painted, you know, or, you know, there's a big thing about the jaguar, of course, and you know all of that, right?
Yeah.
And there's a big emphasis in the art and the depiction of the Olmec heads, where the Olmecs, those beings will have the mouth of the jaguar, right?
Well, actually, that's a great point, because the Paracas had the same thing. in the depictions of some of the people they show them to have like jaguar or puma faces, or at least the teeth. So that's a very interesting.
Or the lips, the shape of the lips.
Exactly that too. Exactly.
And see, again, this seems to be something of an affectation. Uh-huh. In which what they're really saying, it's a metaphor that if they wanted to depict you as, for example, as you are, and they wanted to show that you had, an enlightened state of mind, the way they would depict that is by making your mouth look like the mouth of a jaguar. That means you had entered the other worlds through the jaguar, and that you were, you know, so, you know, kind of now stamped with that overlay. And so it's like a compliment in their world. It didn't mean literally that you had the mouth of a jaguar.
Well, exactly. It's a characteristic, and that's exactly what art is. It's a depiction of, it's a multifaceted depiction of something. It's not a realistic thing. It's a characteristic. Like,
yeah, it's,
you know,
a caricature,
yeah.
Even, if you wanted to put it in a little more modern terms. Well, thank you very much, Brian, for coming on the show, for taking the time, for going through this incredibly aggravating